Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com.
Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and checking on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, recaps, previews, interviews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Every week, I'm alongside my co-host, Fred Alvader, and this week, Kieran Clark will be filling on also in a little while. We're waiting for his call, but in the meantime, I'm going to welcome Fred. Fred, hi, how are you today?
Carlos, I am just a little bit under the weather. I got a little bit of a cold, so I'm going to apologize for any coughing I might do here through the show. But other than that, it was a great, great weekend of golf at the Ryder Cup. Oh, my goodness, what a show the Europeans and the Americans put on. A lot of highlights with that. We're going to take up most of the show tonight talking about the Ryder Cup. There's so many storylines. And then we had the memorial today for Arnold Palmer. We want to talk a little bit about that and some other things in the news we're going to talk about. But, Carlos, the Ryder Cup was it was just off the charts.
Is there anything else to talk about? I mean, of course, Arnie, but is there anything else that happened in the world of golf? I mean, it was an outstanding what can we say? I mean, the U.S., first of all, I have to apologize, right? I picked them to lose again. But, hey, you cannot blame me, okay? They had, if you see it again, they were up 4-0. Then the Euros bounced back on Friday afternoon with 3-1, and they start to be just 2 down. It looked like they were going to climb back in the morning, and I was just commenting with Fred about, to me, it was the show, you have to sum it up with 2 words, and it's not the committee. No, it's not. It's Patrick Reed. I mean, when Pat, they were down, the Euros were storming back. Rafa Cabrera Bello and Sergio Garcia in that last match in the morning against Jordan Spieth and Patrick Reed, when they come back in half that, the air seemed to be thrown out of everyone. I mean, it was deafening when Rafa was making that last putt. It was incredible. The atmosphere had changed. The momentum was on the European side. It looked like USA again was on the way to letting a great lead out, but in came Patrick Reed. When he holed out in his match against Stenson and Rose, everything turned back into the favor of the U.S. From there on, it was Team USA all the way. And then the show that he put on Sunday, I mean, when you look at it still, they were 3 down going into the singles, but if you look at the matchups, the first one was going to be epic because you know that Patrick Reed had that momentum and it was the heart and soul of the U.S. team going against Europe's definitely top player and the one that was taking on also that heart and soul for Team Europe, because what Rory was taking on was also this inspiration that like that what was lacking from not having Ian Poulter in that team. And he was taking on the fans, he was taking on the other players, and it was a show, epic show. And Patrick Reed, he didn't want to have any of it. He went toe-to-toe with Rory McIlroy, match him up. I remember Dikembe Mutombo's fingering, waving, no, 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 no. And that's exactly what he did, the same thing against Rory McIlroy. No, I'm not going to have it here. And definitely it set the tone for what was going to be a great victory by the U.S., definitely a second biggest margin in the history of the Ryder Cup for the American team. And a lot of stars rose up from the new stars, I would say, like Brooks Koepka. Wow, what a great play he had. The Americans played awesome. I think they finally figured it out. No, it wasn't the committee. I'm not going to say that it was the committee. They finally figured it out that you have to play inspirational golf and be playing for your country. Know what it feels, and that's what Patrick Reed votes from the European side. If there were any positives on it, hey, Rory McIlroy definitely is going to be for years to come that top star in the U.S. and the European side. But also Thomas Peters really validated that last pick and then some. Wow, what a player he is. We were saying that he was going to be a great player to watch in the future. And right now, the U.S. got an introduction to what Thomas Peters is and he will be. And Fred, that's all I have to say for now. I really had some personal problems. I couldn't be watching it. I caught up a little bit today on it. That's why Kieran Clark, who just joined us, is going to be with you guys today. So take it over.
Well, Carlos, you summed it up really well from what you were looking at. You pretty much hit the nail on the head. But there's so many storylines that we want to talk about. Heading into the Ryder Cup, the European team was seen to be the huge underdogs. I know you felt that they were going to win, but I think you were the only guy in the world that might have felt that way. You know, Darren Clark brought six rookies to America. You know, one of those rookies, as you just mentioned, Thomas Peters, made a big name for himself, earned 4 points, and looks to be a star in the making. He played really well, seemed to enjoy the big stage, and Rory McIlroy really enjoyed playing with him. They make a great team. After that first session of the foursomes on Friday, when the U.S. swept the session 4-0, it appeared the rout was on. But the Euros battled back, drew close after the third session on Saturday morning. But once again, the U.S. rallied and took a commanding 3-point lead into the singles on Sunday. American captain Davis Love received redemption for the U.S. loss in 2012 at Medina, when he was the captain and is now 1-1 as the leader.
No, Fred, sorry, I have to cut you off there. No, he wasn't the captain. It was Phil Mickelson.
I know.
Yeah, Phil. It was Phil Mickelson.
I'm gonna talk about that later. We gotta stick to the facts here just yet.
Okay,
we're gonna discuss that later.
Sorry.
Task force, Fred. It's all about the task force.
I know. This is the first time the U.S. has won the Cup outright since 2008. It's only the third win for the Americans since 1995. You Euros have had it long enough, Kieran. For the Euros, the youngsters were used sparingly, and the veterans Rory McIlroy, Justin Rose, Henrik Stenson, and Sergio Garcia were counted on to do the heavy lifting. The American team seemed to be unified as a team as never before, and Carlos, I really think that was the secret. And Kieran, they played the American team played like the Europeans. They played as a team and like they really liked each other, rather than as a bunch of individuals. Jordan Spieth, Patrick Reed, Ricky Fowler, as well as Brooks Koepka, led the way for the American team. Every player on the U.S. squad earned at least 1 point, with 7 players earning at least 2, and Reed, Snedeker, and Koepka earning 3 or more. When the dust settled, the Americans held a 17-11 win, and the Ryder Cup will reside in the U.S. for the next 24 months. And Kieran and Carlos, my question is, do you consider this a rout? Carlos, I said it was going to be a rout. I wrote it down. You got it. You recorded it. What were your thoughts on the Ryder Cup, guys?
Well, Kieran,
First, I must apologize for my late entry into the show. I was almost as ineffective as Lee Westwood was during the Ryder Cup there. But I'm here at last.
We'll have to dock your pay for that one, Kieran.
I know. Well, that's okay. Well, well, that's a little bit harsh, but probably fair at the same time. But yeah, so the Ryder Cup itself was obviously, you know, was it a rout? Obviously, it was the biggest defeat for Europe in 35 years. So on paper, it was certainly look as being a rout. And but I think they were always chasing the game after the first session. You know, that clean sweep for America and the Friday four foursomes, that just completely, you know, set the tone for the whole week. And it was really an uphill task for Europe and Darren Clark from there. And I think when we look at Darren Clark's decision-making and picks and pairings that he put together and maybe the mistakes that he made, we have to probably consider the fact that that first session completely blew apart whatever plan he must have had. He had to somehow get back into the game. And at one point, to the Europeans' credit, they almost get back into it. You know, getting back to a couple of points on Saturday, and obviously early on Sunday, maybe potentially trying to... there was a lot of blue on the board early on, but obviously the Americans came back really strongly and achieved what was in the end a very comfortable win. But the Ryder Cup itself always seems to me like, no matter how dominant one side is, it always feels like a contest until about the hour, until the last hour. There's always some kind of variable and potential upset could happen, and anything could happen and change, and momentum could shift and so on. And that's always there. And really, for the Sunday, there was a debate about, you know, could Europe come back or not, and there was obviously some matches that were quite close and whatnot. There weren't too many complete blowouts on Sunday, so it was exciting to watch. But for me, the biggest takeaway from the Ryder Cup is just the sheer standard of play. You know, there were so many birdies from so many players. It was stunning to watch. You know, that Saturday evening four-ball session was just incredible. It was, you know, it was breathtaking at times. The amount of birdies that were being made, the footage of putts was unbelievable. The kind of the shift in matches was incredible. You know, who would have thought that, you know, the great team of Spieth and Reed would have collapsed in the morning to have that match, and then obviously they came back and got the win against Rose and Stenson. So there was so much going on. Then could the Sunday session, you know, better that? And somehow it even surpassed that with the great match. Obviously Rory and Patrick Reed, that was the kind of the contest we're all hoping for, the gladiatorial battle between the two talismanic players for both sides. And on that front nine, at least, it certainly lived up to expectations. You know, the eighth hole when Rory held that huge putt, then Patrick would follow them in. Yeah, that was a real classic Ryder Cup moment that we'll see for years and years to come. But really, of course, the match of the day was Phil and Sergio. That was an unbelievable match. You know, trading 19 birdies between the two of them, two guys that have played in a combined 19 Ryder Cup matches, the two veterans, if you like, going head to head. So that typified what was a real high standard of golf. The golf course was set up to encourage birdies, and the players brought the quality with them. And like Freddie said, the Americans came in, they had a plan, they stuck to that plan, and it certainly worked. And you know, in the end, for me, it's good for the Ryder Cup that we have a competitive competition where either side wins. If Europe had won this one, then it would be a decade since America had last won. And that's not what you want for a competition. You want it to be trading, going back and forth and switching hands each time. That's what keeps it exciting and vibrant. And this victory year for America really sets us up for 2 years' time at Le Golf National in Paris. You know, expectations for both sides now will be even higher for that one.
Most definitely.
Yeah, go ahead, Carlos.
I'm going to finish my final thought today and leave it to you guys. But truly what you all have said, it is true. It was a true route. But I think the Euros were still, like Kieran said, and I mentioned, they were looking at the beginning of Sunday, they were still in it. But at the end of the day, the Americans came through, and like you mentioned, they finally figured it out. They figured out how to play together and be a cohesive unit and forget about their captains or decisions or whatever, and they played to win. And that's what came through, and definitely they routed the Europeans. But to me, I look forward to France already, because the future looks bright. If this is what we're going to be seeing from America, from U.S. now forth, we know that the Europeans will bounce back, especially at home court there in France. But those young players that are coming up on both sides, the rookies that were in Europe half a, they didn't show that great, most of them, but hey, Chris Wood played very well against Dustin Johnson. Again, not to say the same thing about Matthew Fitzpatrick or Andy Sullivan, but hey, the future looks bright, and also in the U.S., the players that have not made it, like Daniel Berger or Justin Thomas. Those are kind of players, just like the ones that are up there right now, like Jordan Spieth and Patrick Reed and Brooks Koepka and Ricky Fowler. Those are fiery players that once they reach that level and get in there in the Ryder Cup, wow, we're going to get a great show. And with this, I'm going to leave the show now. Fred, you take over. I'll be in the controls. So the Back Niners, enjoy the show.
Well, you know, just to sum up a little bit what you guys both said, you know, what I took away from this really is it appears that the depth of the young European stars, they're really set for the next few Ryder Cups. France should be very interesting. With Fitzpatrick, Willett, Sullivan, you know, they failed to earn a point, but they gained valuable experience this time. As you mentioned, Chris Wood, he had his moments. Rafa Cabrera-Bale, you know, played very well in the team competitions. He did not seem to be intimidated by the size of the event. And Thomas Peters, I mentioned him earlier, he looks very solid. So, Kieran, moving on, excuse me. You know, we make fun of it, the best task force ever. you know, and Phil seemed to take the most heat over this task force concept. His response to the media center after the matches were complete was priceless. When asked how the concept came about, Phil said, "Some dumbass opened his mouth in 2014." and he did. He stirred up the controversy when he started talking about Tom Watson and, you know, didn't like the way things were going and they needed to do something and they needed to go in a different direction. And so the whole committee thing ended up. Well, Phil did it again before the week. He started, you know, some controversy with his comments about former captain Hal Sutton. And his pairing with Tiger Woods, he found out late in 2004 at Oakland Hills that Tiger and Phil were going to be paired. So, Kieran, my question to you is, when Phil Mickelson becomes an official captain, will he get credit for captaining this year's team as well?
Well, I think in the end, you know, whatever happens with Phil, whenever he becomes an official captain, as you put it, you know, the scrutiny he's going to be under is going to be incredible. You know, every little mistake he makes is going to be just, you know, criticized everywhere. We're going to be all over it and commenting on it because he's put so much pressure on himself. And really, he put so much pressure on himself this week with his own game. He talked so strongly 2 years ago, and it was obviously a dramatic contrast in the press conferences at the end of the Glen Eagles Ryder Cup where Tom Watson was skewered by Phil Mickelson. The awkwardness there was unbelievable. And then 2 years later, obviously now to the joy and the celebration that they had at Hazeltine there. So, but certainly, you know, the scrutiny he'll be under in 2 years' time, whenever he's a Ryder Cup captain, will be incredible. But I think, in a funny way, the comments he made about Hal Sutton, I think in a strange way, that was almost like a leadership role from Phil. But in the end, he took the heat off the other players and onto himself. But in the end, on the eve of the Ryder Cup, everybody was talking about Phil Mickelson. Nobody was talking about Ricky Fowler or Jordan Spieth or Patrick Reed or Brooks Koepka or anybody else or Davis Love. Nobody was talking about anybody apart from Phil Mickelson. So whether it was his intention or not, and Phil's a smart guy, you know, it took the heat off the team and onto himself. And in the end, you know, the way he played, particularly alongside Matt Kuchar on Saturday, and then, of course, in that tremendous singles match with Sergio, you know, he answered the critics. And the task force concept, obviously, it's a really stupid name for a start. And it's now the Ryder Cup Committee, whatever they call it now. So it sounds a bit better now. But the task force was a really silly name. So it was open to ridicule. But what the Americans did do was they followed, as you said earlier on, Fred, they followed the European pattern of continuity, bringing together various different minds from previous captains, former captains, future captains, vice captains, all these great minds together, creating a plan, really. Because before, the Americans never really had a plan to what they did. Now they had one, and it gave the players the confidence to go out there and actually put on a show. And in the end, obviously, it's all about who plays well on the day and can win. But like any sports team, you have to get, as a coach or as a manager or as a team, you have to give your players the best foundation, the best chance to play well. And I think the Americans, for once, actually gave their players the best chance to play well, both in terms of the organization, in terms of the pairings, in terms of the setup during the week, but also the golf course, where it was laid out as well. It was there for birdies. The Greensboro really suited to those players. And I think all those things came together and made for a really good recipe. And it was really well constructed philosophy from Davis Love and those around him, and they deserve credit for that. Like Paul McGinley got 2 years ago at Glen Eagles, you know, he was a captain in a very similar vein, very organised. The players enjoyed that routine he set out. They had confidence he was making decisions because he'd fought it through. He considered every avenue. And often many captains in the past, like Hal Sutton perhaps, like even Darren Clarke arguably, certainly Tom Watson, seemed to almost make it up as they went along. Well, Davis Love this time and Paul McGinley 2 years ago had a constructed plan. They put it into action and they got the results this time as well.
One other point I want to talk about before we kind of leave the controversy or the trash talking was you probably saw it over there. I didn't read the post, heard about him, but yeah. Danny Willett's brother, Peter, does some blogging there in the UK and said some rather derogatory things about Americans in general, something about being fat and I don't know, whatever, which I kind of fit that description. You know, that got a lot of press early in the matches before they really got going, and Danny Willett had to answer a lot of questions in the media center about that. You got any thoughts on those?
Well, I think there's two things here. One, I think the article itself was supposed to be a satirical sort of comic view of the American golf fans and whatever else, but I don't think it was particularly one. I don't think it was very well written. It wasn't very funny, and secondly, the timing of it was terrible. And I think Peter Willett, you know, he started blogging really around when Danny won the Masters, because he was on Twitter and he made a lot of amusing comments and funny comments about Danny's his time with Danny over the years and whatnot. And he's a smart guy, he's a teacher, and I think to some extent he's tried to sort of ride the wave of Danny's newfound fame recently. So it wasn't the best timing. However, what I will say about the whole thing, I think it was completely overblown from the European standpoint. I don't think Darren Clarke handled it very well. I'm not sure rushing out to the golf course when Danny was practicing and then telling Danny all about it and then getting him to go and apologize to Davis Love and apologize to everybody for something that had nothing to do with him, I don't think that was very wise captaincy from Darren Clarke. And I think that unsettled Danny Willett, it kind of ruined his week, and it set the tone for what was a really disappointing debut Ryder Cup. So I don't think Darren Clarke handled it very well. I'm not sure it really was in the radar of too many American golf fans or even media guys or even Davis Love. He hadn't even read the article as well. So, but Darren Clarke, I think, desperately trying to appease everybody, made an issue out of something that wasn't really that controversial. However, as I say, I think the article was poorly written, poorly constructed. It wasn't the wisest timing to do it. That said, and of course Danny Willett kind of unwisely as well commented on this on Twitter, you know, some of the American golf fans did actually fit that description. However, the point is, it wasn't wise to do, and I think Peter Willett should apologize to his brother about this and everybody else. But as I say, the person who handled it worst of all was Darren Clarke. He should have just handled it himself as the captain. Don't get Danny Willett involved in this. And for me, I feel sorry for Danny Willett because it was his debut Ryder Cup. He's a Masters champion. And I think both his brother and indeed his captain contributed to what was a really, really disappointing week for him.
Yeah, it seemed to upset him. He didn't handle it really well at the media center either. So, yeah, I think it was a problem. Yeah, it was a distraction for sure. You know, Kieran, I want to talk a little bit about the size of the event that the Ryder Cup has become and the spectacle and the gala. To me, some of the stuff's getting just a little bit out of hand. You know, all the wives and the friends and everyone in different outfit every day. And, I mean, you know, just it's unbelievable. I didn't notice it so much from the Euros, but the American team is just making this completely ridiculous. Now, on the other hand, the size of the crowds, I mean, it was off the charts. We're talking 45,000 people for the practice round, and they all stuck around for the opening ceremony. That didn't begin until 4 p.m. The number of fans surrounding the stage was tremendous. I mean, it resembled a football game at the University of Minnesota, for goodness sake. The crowds on the weekend were over 50,000. The stands would fill up at every hole waiting for the groups to come through. You know, when the lead group of Mickelson and Fowler and Rory and Thomas Peters was on number 9 on Saturday morning, the stands at number 16 was completely full, and over 15,000 fans ringed the fairway, and the players, I mean, they weren't even going to reach that hole for another hour and a half. It's just you, walking along with the groups, it was really difficult to see anything. You were 12, 14, 18 deep. You know, you were standing 30, 40 yards away from the ropes, let alone the greens and the tees. So I it amazed me that people would spend money to go to walk around in that crowd and only see four groups on the golf course at any one time. There just isn't much you can see. So from my standpoint, being there and seeing that, that just blew my mind. Then on the other point, before I turn it back over to you, the TV ratings were pretty solid. Sunday's Ryder Cup coverage, 4.3 million viewers. That's up 95% versus 2014 when it was in Scotland, down slightly from 2012 when it was at Medina. But Golf Channel saw like 121% increase in live from Ryder Cup, up 82% on different times. So the TV ratings were really, really strong for the Ryder Cup, and I just have to – it has to go back to the quality of play and the personalities that were involved. And NBC and Golf Channel did a great job covering as far as I'm concerned. What are your thoughts, Kieran?
Yeah, I think the Ryder Cup itself has become such a huge worldwide global sporting event. You know, it's been so – it has those kind of elements people like. You know, it has an adversarial, you know, gladiatorial back and forth, two sides going head to head. It has that kind of slight level of antagonism to it, kind of tension, rivalry there, and people enjoy that sort of thing, much like a conventional, you know, football game, whatever, NFL, and that's the same sort of thing there. It's all about rivalries, and that's what drives the narrative and drives the attention. People get inspired to watch it because they want to see one team beat another and see what happens, even if you're not particularly invested in it. And obviously, when it's obviously people are there supporting their country, that's even bigger. That attracts people as well. So there's no other event quite like it in terms of attracting regular sports fans, not necessarily golf fans. And the Ryder Cup over the years has been very good at commercializing itself, and they keep doing it all the time. They keep selling more tickets every year, bringing more people in, selling more merchandise, selling more alcohol, selling more whatever else. And that also has its downsides as well. And I think, as you say, with some of the crowd conduct, as much as it happens all the time, happens everywhere, we've seen some instances of that happening in this side of the pond as well. But I think the scale of it at times was ridiculous. Of course, it's only a small minority of fans, but it's still a significant minority of fans who acted poorly. So I think going forward, the Ryder Cup has to ask itself, is it going to become a completely kind of commercialized event where it's all about the dollar, it's all about making money, and when you do that, you almost lose the soul, you almost lose the heart that maybe Tony Jacklin and Jack Nicklaus illustrated back in 1969. You lose that kind of, you know, kind of respect about it, and I think there was a distinct lack of respect at times from a lot of people, from a lot of the players at times. Admittedly, actually, most of the American players conducted themselves very, very well, and I think they were at times embarrassed by the crowd behaviour. Jordan Spieth in particular looked very upset about some of the comments that were coming out of the crowd, some of the European players, which are really, you know, really tough, really personal. And it's not the first time it's happened either. So what happens is when you have folk coming to the grounds drinking from first 7 o'clock in the morning throughout the day, you know, that's a problem. And eventually in the afternoon it opens the door for the idiots to come and make a noise for themselves. And I think also the Ryder Cup as a whole, whenever it's in Europe or in America, every single time they try and make it bigger and bigger, they try and make it louder as well, and they encourage everybody to get noisier and rowdier. And when you do that, you're just opening the door for the minority of idiots to come in and spoil it. And I think there was, at times it was frustrating to watch, and it was very disappointing to see, and it did take away from some of the golf. And it was only the players' credit that they played so well and conducted themselves so well, they actually overcame that and turned the spectacle into being about them and not anybody else. So I think the Ryder Cup, the scale of it is obviously huge internationally, not just in the US. You know, it's a big watched event around the world because it brings, it's a very unique thing having a team event in golf, and it has so much, it shifts all the time. And this one here was so unpredictable, how each session almost felt like its own Ryder Cup itself. You know, who would have thought it had been 4-0 to the Americans after the first session, and who would have believed the Europeans would have come back so well on Saturday? So it's an exciting event. They publicise it so well, they commercialise it really well. But at the same time, I think there is a danger if they don't watch it in the coming years, that they could lose the heart of the event, and it could become just a bit over the top and a bit too excessive. And when you cross that line, it's very hard to get back from it. However, certainly the size of the crowds were incredible. It was a great spectacle to see. The weather was great, obviously. It was very colourful and very loud. But I think they have to do a better job at policing some of the idiots in the crowd. And I think the American players, and Captain Davis Love in particular, spoke brilliantly about this as well, getting his son actually to throw the guy that was abusing Rory. You know, I think the PGA of America and those who run the Ryder Cup have to look closely at how they manage the alcohol sales and how they can actually try and improve policing of the crowd itself.
Yeah, unfortunately, there were a few negative reactions with the crowds. You know, as you mentioned, Rory even went into the crowd and confronted one unruly heckler himself. Sergio took a tremendous amount of heckling from the crowd. He was not real happy about it, but he controlled himself. He lived with it. He talked about it briefly in the media center after the Ryder Cup was over. He realizes he came to find out actually during the Ryder Cup that he hadn't won a major yet. He didn't know that, but the crowd kept reminding him, so now he knows. One fan yelled in Henrik Stenson's backswing, causing him to pull the ball out of bounds. But as soon as they looked around, all the crowd turned and pointed to this idiot. And so he was immediately ejected. They hauled him out right away. The yelling and taunting was somewhat out of hand at times. You know, I contribute that, you know, you mentioned a little bit about alcohol, but also the mob mentality. You know, when you're in a group like that, there's always going to be somebody that thinks they have to, you know, kind of have to do something outlandish. And when you have that many people confined in that small of a space with probably a little bit too much alcohol consumed over long days in an emotionally charged atmosphere like that, you know, you get those kind of reactions. So you're probably right on. I the PGA Tour and the European Tour, they're going to have to address the alcohol consumption and sales going forward, I'm sure. And, you know, even Rory said in the post-tournament, post-event media center, he says, you know what, he said, I'd love to be outside the ropes doing it. He says, I'd probably be like that too. I'd be drinking all day, and he said, I'd probably be going, I'd be yelling and whooping, you know. I would love to do that. And he smiled, and he sincerely meant it, you know. He would love to do that. But he understands. But, you know, people just, they have to take a little bit more responsibility for themselves. Man, it just, they get out of hand. Well, Kieran, let's talk a little bit more about particular players. Thomas Peters, what, you know, you've been watching him. You see him there in Europe. We've seen him a little bit here. He went to school in Illinois. He's a top player. Carlos and I talked about him maybe being the guy to have a really good week, that they needed him to play well. And man, he sure did. What, he set a record or something, first one ever to get 4 points in his rookie appearance or whatever. So, well, what's your feeling on Thomas Peters?
Well, he's a brilliant player, and you know, even though it's obviously a tremendous performance from a rookie to win 4 points, as you say, a record for a European debutant in the event, it doesn't come as a massive surprise to those of us who kind of have watched him closely, because he's an incredible talent. You know, he hits the ball so far off the tee, he's a great putter when he gets going, and he has a tremendous ability under pressure. He's so calm and cool. You know, people looked at him in the first tee, he wasn't so showing much emotion. You wonder if he was really nervous. It's more that's what he's always like. He's very cool and composed. And he obviously played so well. And at times he carried Rory in that partnership they had. And actually, in the first day, he was paired with Lee Westwood, who had an absolute nightmare. And it was only thanks to Thomas Peters that match lasted as long as it actually did. He carried the experienced player in that match, and he carried on the rest of the week, and this was superb. And actually, I'll be seeing Thomas Peters in about 9 hours' time when he comes into the media centre at St Andrews for the Dunhill Links Championship, and I'm sure we'll ask him about his week at the Ryder Cup, and we'll talk to him about that and how he feels about going forward. And you know, obviously, it's going to be a regular thing. He's going to be someone who's going to be a big figure in the Ryder Cup team in years to come. But when he was picked, you know, it was a pick that nobody could really criticise, because he played alongside Darren Clarke in Denmark two weeks before the picks were made. And obviously, he knew the situation. Darren had asked to be paired with him so he could watch him up close before the picks were made. He was a potential option. And what did Thomas Peters do? He went out on the first day in Denmark, and he shot 62, which Darren Clarke describes as one of the best rounds of golf he's ever seen in his life. So that answered there. Could he handle that spot and that pressure? Yes, he did. on to win the tournament. So he showed under pressure that he could do that to the captain. He was always going to be a pick from that point onwards. And you know, he has, as I say, tremendous power off the tee. He's just cool under pressure, a great putter. And he's someone we've kind of identified for a while now as being potentially the next big thing coming out of Europe. He's a guy I think is going to be destined for the world's top 10 in the next couple of years, you know, maybe even earlier than that. And I think he's going to be a potential major champion going forward. He has all the attributes to be a success in the modern game now, which is all about power and putting. He has both those attributes. And, you know, he's cool and actually, as well, he's very cool and composed, but he's got a very good sense of humour as well. He's a bit like Henrik Stenson in the sense that he doesn't give much away personally. You see him regularly, but he has a very dry sense of humour. So he's a very interesting young guy. As you say, Fred, he was at university in Illinois. So he has that slight American twang to his Belgian accent. So I think when he gets to the PGA Tour, I'm assuming he's going to be there very soon. He might even play in some of the fall events coming up, certainly into next year. And he'll get a PGA Tour card very soon. He's going to be a real big success in the PGA Tour. You know, a lot of guys come into the Ryder Cup or any other event, play well, and then they disappear and you kind of forget about them. We've seen names like that in the past. But Thomas Peters is about as close to a lock as being the real deal as you can possibly get. This guy really is that good, and he's going to be a great player for years to come. And him and Rory, you know, that's going to be a potentially great partnership for Europe, and we get into France and onwards. So it's he's a very exciting talent, and by far the most exciting talent in Europe right now.
Yeah, I got to watch him hit balls on the range on Thursday a little bit. And he went out and played with the other three young guys, and I purposely watched him, and I'm impressed. He is a player. I liked his whole thing. Let's talk just a little bit about you know, you mentioned Clark's mistakes. You know, you mentioned maybe Willett, how he handled his brother's Peter Willett situation there. You talked about maybe Clark kind of making decisions by the seat of his pants a little bit. Kieran, I really felt, and I told this to Carlos back when Clark chose Lee Westwood over Russell Knox, I said, that's it. They will not win. That's it. When you're choosing guys simply because they've been on the team in the past and they're good guys, that doesn't work. We've seen that on the U.S. side. You know, that doesn't work. Russell Knox should have been on the team. I mean, I don't know that they would have won with Russell Knox on the team, but they weren't going to win with Lee Westwood on the team. It wasn't going to happen. And I really think that was his biggest mistake right there.
Yeah, I think it kind of set the tone. And I think the Ryder Cup in Europe is very dangerously close, if it isn't already having done so, to becoming, you know, like a club for a certain clique of players and guys on the European Tour. You know, the Darren Clark, Lee Westwood, Ian Poulter crew, you know, they seem to... It's almost like they're picking their best mates almost, and that's an unhealthy thing to go down. That said, obviously Lee Westwood brings an awful lot of experience. Darren is someone who is interested in stats, and he had an idea that obviously if he had more than six rookies, you know, the odds of winning the Ryder Cup are extremely slim. And we saw what happened in '99 at Brookline when Mark James had seven rookies. And he didn't pick Bernard Langer, he didn't pick Nick Faldo, but of course they played great until the final day when America came back at them. And I think Darren wanted to avoid that sort of thing happening to him. But Lee Westwood is somebody who, you know, he hasn't played that well this year, apart from the odd occasion. Obviously, at the Masters, he played great. The end of the US Open, he played all right there for 3 days. Then he completely and utterly collapsed on the last day. And Lee Westwood hasn't won a tournament for an awful long time. And neither, on the other hand, is Martin Kaymer, who was the other pick, of course, that he made. He didn't play well either during the Ryder Cup. You know, Martin Kaymer is also a younger guy, about 2 years ago, major champion, so you can understand that pick more than Lee Westwood potentially. But that said, Martin Kaymer hasn't won since the US Open either. So two guys here who haven't won in a couple of years. So you haven't had, and the Ryder Cup's such a pressure, intense situation nowadays. It's a cauldron of pressure. You have to have guys there who can handle the utmost scrutiny and strain and under pressure. And Westwood and Kaymer haven't done that recently. Russell Knox has won twice in the past year. He's won a WGC. He won recently, of course, back in August in the PGA Tour. He is a recent winner. And
you can see Knox getting better for the last 3 years. He's just getting better and better. He's been building up.
Exactly. He's continually improved over the last few years, as you say. And he's someone who, you know, he should have been on the team, I think. People say I'm biased because he's from Scotland and all the rest. But I think the way he played throughout the year, under pressure, he went out and he won an event. But I think in the end, I spoke about this a few weeks ago when we did a show before, was that I think Russell Knox, unfortunately, isn't part of the club. He isn't a European tour guy. He went to college in America when he was 18, and he isn't part of that crew. He didn't play in a European tour. And I think, to an extent, that slightly goes against him. He's not one of the guys. But I don't think Darren Clarke made it too much of an effort to actually make him one of the guys. He didn't go out there. Russell came over this year and he played at the BMW at Wentworth. He played Scottish Open. He played in Ireland. And Darren Clarke didn't once play with him. And Darren could pick any player he wanted to play with in any event this year. And he played everybody else. He didn't play a Russell Knox. I don't think he was particularly serious at any point in picking Russell Knox, despite the success that he had. And Thomas Peters winning in Denmark gave him the excuse, therefore, to pick Peters rather than Knox. In the end, the argument, Peters should have been there, absolutely. But the argument should have been Lee Westwood. You know, he should not have been there, I'm afraid. And you know, experience is one thing, but if you want experience, why don't you pick Bernard Langer or Colin Montgomery? You know, those guys, obviously, they don't play at that level anymore, but neither does Lee Westwood. He's not the player he was a few years ago. And I feel for him as well, because he was put under that situation on Saturday where he missed that short putt in the last hole, and that kind of typified his week. And obviously losing the clinching match against Ryan Moore, that also kind of set, defined his week as well. So it was a shame for Lee Westwood, but again, I think that was the first mistake. Like you, Fred, I think we can sit and second-guess everything here, but I think it sent out the wrong message that Darren Clarke was not there picking the best team. He was picking, you know, his friends, people he was comfortable with himself. I'm not sure that's the best way to go down. Look at America. You know, Bubba Watson's world number 7. He was a guy just outside the points list. America didn't pick him. They picked Ryan Moore, and he went and got the winning point. So America had a different philosophy. They picked the guys they thought were going to be best for the team. Europe, I don't think they quite did that successfully. And I think they paid for it as well. Of course, whether it would have changed the result or not is unlikely, because the Americans played so well. But I think, you know, Lee Westwood being there did not enhance the European team. If you want him there for his experience and his behind-the-scenes camaraderie and all those intangibles, then make him a vice-captain. There's plenty of them as there is. Make him another one. Have him there with the guys. And people run about rookies all the time. These guys are no longer rookies. They play major championships. They play big pressure events. Guys at Russell Knox, he's won millions of dollars recently. They're not rookies in the sense that they were 20, 30 years ago when guys played in Europe and came over to America and were daunted by it. That's no longer the case. And look at Thomas Peters. Look at Rafa Cabrera-Bello. Those rookies, look at Brooks Koepka. Rookies can be great because they're young, they're fresh, they're hungry, and generally speaking, they're in form and at the peak of their careers. And those are the guys you want in your team. And I agree with you, Fred. That was the first mistake that Darren Clarke made, was not picking Russell Knox. And also as well, Paul Casey, who's would comfortably be among the top 10 European players in the world right now by far. And he's not even a member of the European Tour. Why didn't he try to qualify for the European Ryder Cup team? Well, between you and me, he doesn't like Darren Clarke. Put it that way. That's all it is. So Darren Clark's presence disrupted that, because it was not the strongest European team there. He didn't have Paul Casey. Didn't have Russell Knox. And in the end, they paid for that.
You know, it was almost like at the post-tournament conference, the first thing Darren said, first thing he said was, these young players played so well, we knew we were maybe at a disadvantage, but we're learning and we're building a new... I'm sorry. Please.
Are you okay there, Freddie?
No, not really.
Don't die.
Really. he trotted that out right away, that, well, we're a young team. It's almost like he was a caretaker for this time. They're going to bite the bullet, bring all these rookies on, and, you know, whatever happened. They knew they were going to lose, and, you know, they'll just worry about it going down the road. I mean, it was almost like, you know, we need the Americans to win to keep the market strong in the United States for the Ryder Cup, to keep the people watching. I almost got that feeling, Kerry, and I don't know about you, but I kind of got that feeling a little bit.
Well, I think that was more of a case of Darren Clarke just kind of getting there straight away and trying to cover himself for any criticism. And actually, Darren Clarke has completely disappeared from the planet right now. He was actually due to play in the Dunhill Links Championship this week at St Andrews, and he withdrew from that event very quickly. So he did not want to come over here and face any more questions from anybody about the Ryder Cup. And actually, oddly enough, Paul Laurie, who was one of his vice captains, has also withdrawn from Dunhillings, a Scottish player, a guy who's won that event. He's withdrawn as well. So they're wanting to avoid the hard questions. And Darren Clark's somebody who he is an alienating figure. He has some really strong allies in the European Tour. A lot of guys like him, but an awful lot don't. And a lot of media people have met the wrong side of Darren Clark over the years. And I think in the end, once things kind of settle down, I think the knives would have come out for him. And I think he's trying to avoid that attention. People will criticise the picks. They'll criticise why he broke up the Cabrera-Bello-Garcia pairing on Saturday afternoon. Why on earth did Lee Westwood appear again on Saturday after his performance on Friday? These are questions you'll have to answer. Of course, whether it would have changed the result or not, we don't know, but they were clearly mistakes. Obviously, no captain can get anything right because, in the end, it's down to the players. But when you've seen guys like Keimer, like Westwood, that first day, play as poorly as they did, why put them back on a Saturday? Why did Andy Sullivan, who played quite well on Friday morning, why was he not, again, appeared on the team until Sunday? Why did Chris Wood, who played great on the Saturday morning, where did he go? So there's so many questions here for Dan Clark to answer, and right now he's not wanting to answer them.
Let's continue on with that just a little bit, talk about who did well. We already talked about Patrick Reed, 3-1-1 for 3.5 points. He led the American team, and he basically carried Jordan Spieth through their team matches. Spieth did not play all that great. He played okay, but not great. They took down, Love sent him out there in that first match against Rory McIlroy, and you knew that Darren was going to send those three or four guys out there early on Sunday trying to load some blue on the board. And, that first match, that was clutch. And Reed getting that win, that was dynamite. That was a big deal. Then you got Brant Snedeker and Brooks Koepka, who both earned 3 points. Koepka just keeps getting better and better. He's a young guy, and, as he gains confidence, we're going to see more and more of him. I'm not going to get into the Euros just yet, but I'll let you answer about the Americans' best. But that's what I saw right there from the American team, that those three guys, Reed, Snedeker, Koepka, they really energized the team and did well.
Well, Patrick Reed was essentially the leader of the team from the front. And, I saw a lot of people who were questioning Davis Love's singles plan on Sunday, putting out Reed first, thinking, well, he's going to play Rory, and that's going to be a tough game. Sure, you'd put Reed somewhere else, so he's a guaranteed point against a lesser player. I don't understand that philosophy at all. To me, Patrick Reed has shown all week he was your leader, he was your best player, and what message would it be to him if you were to say to him, well, Patrick, I know you want to play Rory, but I'm going to move you to another match because I don't think you're good enough to beat Rory. That would be a terrible message to send to Patrick Reed now and the entire team. So Love had the strength of his convictions to put Reed out first. He obviously gave him an opportunity to give him the stage to make it his own, to play against Europe's best player, and he made it his own, and he won that match brilliantly. And Reed, obviously, if he could play like that every other week on the tour, he'd be a top five player in the world. He'd be number one, probably.
He'd never lose.
They never lose. And he gets that red, white, and blue on him. He's intense. He's a strange character, Patrick Reed. But when he gets that red, white, and blue on him, he's something else. And obviously, we saw it at Glen Eagles, of course, 2 years ago. Him and Spieth playing well together. We had it again, obviously, more on his part playing well. But Spieth was there too. I think maybe the two of them are actually comfortable together. So that maybe helps Patrick in those team matches, even if Jordan didn't actually contribute too much on the course. But Reed was Captain America, as they sort of named him throughout the week, and he was inspirational. And you need your best players to step up to the mark. America throughout the years hasn't had that in recent times. Tiger never really stepped up to the mark in the Ryder Cup. Phil, for all his, he has recently, in fairness, but in 10, 12 years ago, Phil wasn't a great player. Jim Furyk, Davis Love, they were not great Ryder Cup players, despite being fantastic players on the tour. And Europe, over the years, their best players did step up. Seve stepped up, Faldo stepped up, Bernard Langer stepped up, obviously Lee Westwood, those guys, they were all great. Colin Montgomery over the years, Ian Poulter, Rory McIlroy. America now has a figure they can build a team around going forward, and his name is Patrick Reed. And he was absolutely superb. And again, that first match on Sunday, that was so critical for momentum, for confidence, really setting the tone of the day. And Reed winning that match, that set the tone for America, because after that point, that was a huge blow to the confidence of Europe to just have that first big red on the board, match number one, first point to America. After that point, I think it was almost insurmountable for Europe, and it showed that to be true. But Patrick Radinho, it's amazing the intensity he has there, the way he plays, but I think Captain Love did the right thing, put him out first there, put the confidence in him to go out there and take down Europe's best player, because people could overanalyse these things and think, well, you should put him against Lee West because he'll definitely beat Lee West. Well, that's nonsense. You know, you put him up against your best player, your best player against their best player, see who wins, and the American guy won this time, and that set a tone for what was obviously a great day for the U.S.
Yeah, I don't think people realize that, you know, the Euros won three of the first five matches.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
They were playing pretty good, you know.
Exactly, Fred. In the end, had Europe, say, Rory had won the first match, and Justin Rose had beaten Ricky Fowler, suddenly Europe have won all five of the first matches. Suddenly, you're thinking of Medina all over again. So Davis Love put a really balanced lineup. Some strong guys at the top to try and counter the strong front that Europe would have definitely had given they had to chase the points. So you have also some strong names in the middle like Mickelson and Koepka and Snedeker, who also played very well last week as well. Dustin Johnson was there too. He actually, of course, won a point on Sunday. He was a bit of a disappointment at the Ryder Cup. He got his point on Sunday against Chris Wood. And then obviously at the end there you have Koepka, Kuchar, Mr. Solid, and then obviously Zach Johnson, kind of the guy you want at the bottom there, a guy you can rely on. He got his point in the end against Fitzpatrick. So I think Love a really balanced lineup. He took on the lessons of Medina, try and counteract the strong surge from Europe at the start. Because I think Europe had a chance on Sunday. They had to win probably five of the first six matches, if not all six, to have a real chance. They didn't do that. And in the end, America had a really comfortable win in the end, of course. So I think Love did the right thing. Best guy out first, but you know, Jordan Stevens will get match two. JB Holmes played okay, and Ricky Fowler, finally, you know, he actually had a better week. He hadn't had the best Ryder Cup record, but he got some points on the board this time. And obviously Phil Mickelson came up and stepped up to the mark as well. And Jimmy Walker, a major champion, obviously got against Cabrera Bale, lost up. A good match actually between those two, but I think Love
was
the right
Bale played out of his mind. He was
great.
Walker
yeah.
would hit a great shot, and Bale would hit it inside of him. It was unbelievable.
Well, that's right, and that defined, you know, those matches, you know, really, obviously we talk about the McIlroy-Reed match, but Cabrera Bale against Walker was tremendous, but obviously Sergio and Mick Phil, the standard was incredible, they were going back and forth. So, for me, as a golf fan, I'm not too vested in who wins the thing, I don't really care, as long as it's close and interesting. And this weekend, it wasn't close on the points tally, but most of the matches are fairly close, and also the standard of golf was just unbelievable, and it was genuinely edge of the seat, breathtaking to watch.
The other point I wanted to make about the singles was that I really felt that the bottom half of the European team, the four rookies and a couple other guys, Westwood, were not any match for the bottom six of the American team. I really felt the depth of the American team would win out in the singles, and that's exactly what happened. These last six matches, five of them were won by the Americans. Only one, Keimer got the only win for the Euros against Kuchar, and that was just a one-up win. And Kuchar started out three up and then let Keimer back in. So, that's really sealed the deal. I mean, it was done before that, but I really felt that the Americans were much deeper and would really win the singles on Sunday. I really felt that.
But I think in the end, sorry Fred, just quickly say, I think in the end, Europe lost the Ryder Cup on the Friday morning. That was such a huge hurdle to come back from. And they came near, and obviously Saturday morning they got back to one point. But then that Saturday afternoon, a three-point deficit against that American team, it was always going to be a big ask on Sunday.
Yeah, you're exactly right. We talked about Thomas Peters, 4-1 paired with Rory and the team, looks to be a permanent partner. He won his singles match over J.B. Holmes. Henrik Stenson, Rafa, and Keimer were the only other Euros that won singles matches on Sunday. You mentioned Rafa Cabrera-Bello. He looked great. Why he didn't stay with Sergio and keep playing, I don't know. They seem to pair up very good together. Rory McIlroy, we haven't talked about Rory, and I have to bring this up. Rory really played well. I mean, he played inspired golf. He was the second highest point earner for the Euros, playing against the best the Americans have every time. 3-2-0 record. And that singles match, we talked about it, you know, with Reed was a classic. That was the most entertaining match I've ever seen in golf. I enjoyed watching that so much. I didn't want it to end. It was so great. And Rory alluded to it, you know, he kind of maybe burned himself out. He expended so much energy on the front nine, but he was trying to drive. He was trying to win the points. He was trying to win the holes. He was trying to drive the crowd. He was trying to do so much, and he kind of wore himself out. And he said he really felt it on the back nine. He just didn't quite have it. But you know what? He played fantastic. And he, as you mentioned earlier, he is the true leader of the European team.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing how we think of Rory when he first came into the Ryder Cup team 6 years ago. He infamously said that he didn't really care about it. It was just an exhibition. And now, 6 years down the line, he is the most fired-up Ryder Cup player you've ever seen. Even Ian Poulter has never acted like that sometimes. Some of the fist-pumping and the shouting, he was so pumped up for it. And it was a complete transformation on Rory from 6 years ago. He's matured as a golfer. I think he really embraced being a senior member of the team, being the leader of the team, and he's now older, not obviously too old, but he's so experienced now with being a four-time major champion. He enjoyed that role of actually helping Thomas Peters, bringing in the rookies and leading from the front. And I think you're right. I think actually a lot of the European players may have expended too much energy because they were chasing. You know, Clark put out Sergio all five matches, Rory all five matches, Peters all five matches, Rose and Stenson all five matches. Obviously, some of them played quite well, but I think on a Saturday afternoon that showed there. I think a lot of them ran out of gas towards the end there. But that, again, came from the Friday morning where they had to chase from that point. That's obviously, I said before, where the Ryder Cup was really lost. But Rory was great. I say he's embraced that new role. He's now the leader of the team. And when we get to France in 2 years' time, he's going to continue that intensity onwards. But I've never seen him. You know, Rory's such a likable character, such a really kind of down-to-earth guy, and a really quite a pleasant, amiable character. So it was quite something to see him acting the way he did at times during the Ryder Cup, but he was so into it, and it was fun to watch. And, he and Reed, they bounced off each other on that final day, and what I loved the most was, they both gave it the big gestures and the shushes and the big fist pumps, but then when they both hold those great putts in the eighth, they had a small brief embrace,
yep.
And I thought that was
yep.
kind of a nice touch there, and it really defined what was a classic match, as you say.
Yep, that was fabulous. The Phil Sergio thing, you mentioned off the top, 19 birdies. both shot 63. I know. It was just, and Phil was disappointed he didn't win. How could you, my goodness, the guy shoots 9 birdies against you. I'm tickled to death to get a half if I'm him, but he thought he had it won. That was just, that is a match for the ages. Those two matches alone, Rory and Reed and Phil and Sergio, those two matches, to me, would be worth the price of admission. They were fantastic.
Oh, absolutely. The Phil-Sergio match was so reminiscent of Phil and Henrik at the Open Championship at Royal Troon.
Yeah.
That real back and forth guys
that.
Just trading
yeah.
blows. Yeah.
yeah.
One guy holds a putt, it's a great shot, the other guy follows him. And Phil this year can feel extremely unlucky. He shoots almost a record score at Royal Troon. He finishes 9 shots ahead of the guy in third, loses the Open Championship. And here, he makes 9 birdies ten birdies on the last day of the Ryder Cup. And he still doesn't win his match as well. So Phil this year has been the nearly man. But he's played some amazing golf, and Phil at 46, he's got arthritis and all these different things, but somehow Phil, for all his faults and for all his character flaws and for all whether you like him or not, the game of golf will be a duller and more boring place without Phil Mickelson there, because he talks a very good game, he always gives you a good quote and stokes controversy and great stories, but when he gets onto the golf course and when he feels it, when he wants it, he's such a remarkable player. And Sergio, to his credit, a guy who we've always thought he can't hold putts, he's not good under pressure. And Sergio was great. And actually, those two I don't think necessarily got on too well. So I think there's a bit of rivalry there too. But it made for a really, really exciting match. And in the end, it was a shame it was actually kind of the undercard match to Reed and Rory, because Phil and Sergio, that could have headlined any Ryder Cup.
Oh, absolutely. The last point I want to make, Ryan Moore, who was the captain's pick, the last guy in the whole thing, he was two down going into 16. And he saw the guys behind him were playing pretty well. So, you know, the pressure, he felt kind of the pressure was off, looked like they were going to get enough points to win. He could have just folded his tent. But, you know, he says, you know what, I'm here. I want to do well for the team. I don't want to let the team down. I got to turn this thing around. And he stakes it with that second shot on 16 onto the green. You know, he goes eagle, birdie, par, wins the all three holes. It excuse me, ends up winning the match over Lee Westwood. And, you know, we were criticizing Lee Westwood, and he really had the match in hand on the singles. And Ryan Moore turns around and gets a clinching point. I thought that was really good stuff.
Absolutely, and Moore himself is kind of the antithesis, the complete opposite to the absolute madness and intensity of Rory and Patrick. You know, Ryan Moore is one of the coolest guys around. He shows no emotion. He's just a little kind of, you know, nod of the head maybe. We see like Rory and Patrick giving it the fist bumps and the shouting and so on, and just running around greens. It was quite funny to watch just how calm and composed Ryan Moore was. But even he had a little fist bump when he got that point, because Ryan Moore, he came in late, obviously, an awkward situation, really, the first time it's ever really happened. So it was a unique experiment there. And he hadn't got the points during the week. He hadn't played that well during Natural Weather Cup itself. But on that last day, he turned on at the end there, and he ensured he played his part in getting a point to America. And it's certainly an experience that you can look back on in the past and in the future and actually look back on positively, because he did his bit. Like you say, Fred, every single American player contributed at some point, and that is the definition of a team.
Well, we can't leave this thing without talking about Bubba just a little bit. You know, Bubba wasn't picked for the team. He was seventh in the world. But he went and said, hey, I'd like to be a vice captain. Will you let me come as a vice captain? And so Davis picked him up and brought him in. And at the end, did you see Bubba? He was so emotional. He said, you know, this is the greatest thing that I've ever been involved in. You know, I want this. I want to do this. I want to be a captain. I want to be involved with the Ryder Cup. That was a completely different side of Bubba Watson. I did not see that coming.
Yeah, it was a very kind of obviously strange situation, Bubba begging to come along for the ride in the end. But when he was there, I think he was someone who, he has a military dad, he's very patriotic, he's never really been one of the guys. And I think this week he felt included, he felt part of something. And I think that means a lot to him. You know, he's a complicated character, he has his, you know, flaws, and like we all do. And but I think this week was really the coming of age of Bubba Watson in some way, not as necessarily a golfer, but as a person, as a team member. He was embraced by everybody else. I think he enjoyed being part of that team. And I must say, Fred, I'm not sure if we're going to mention him, but it's amazing we got through an hour of this show, and you haven't once mentioned one of the other vice captains by the name of Tiger Woods. I'm amazed. I can't believe that.
Well, you know what? He really kept a low profile. You know, even when he was asked the question, I'm just here for the team, I'm doing my job, you know, we want the team to do well, I'm just here supporting the team. He did not seek it. I mean, he didn't even like being introduced, you know, at the opening ceremony and that kind of thing. He poo-pooed everything. He stayed in the background. He did not want the attention on him. You know what? And I think he gained a lot of fans back for the way that he conducted himself this weekend.
I completely agree. And obviously his pod, where Spieth and Reed were in that pod of his, and I think those two guys, you know, having Tiger Woods there, you know, arguably one of the best players ever, some would say the best ever, certainly in the top two or three, one of the all-time greats, a guy who, for two guys like Reed and Spieth in their 20s, Tiger would have been their idol when they were growing up, the guy they watched as when they were kids. And to have him there alongside you, what a psychological confidence boost that must be to have a 14-time major champion on your side, a guy who has, you know, he has, like him or not, he's one of the great golfing brains out there of all time. And to tap into that knowledge and that experience, a little arm round the shoulder maybe. I think Tiger played a very kind of unsung role in this Ryder Cup. I think he was a very important part of it. And I think psychologically having Tiger Woods there help give those guys an edge. You know, it's going to, because he's such a great figure and an iconic legend of the game. And to have him there, I think, was a real coup for the American team, and it was a great move for them. And I think for Tiger, like you say, Fred, I think it was a good move for him. It showed a different side of Tiger, more unassuming background role. I think he embraced it. And when he inevitably becomes a Ryder Cup captain in the future, he'll be much better suited for that role now, having had this experience this week.
Well, you know, and it's such a turnaround, Kieran, because I felt for years that the U.S. did not benefit from having Tiger Woods on the team. Yes, he was the best player in the world for a long time, but he came in with, you know, his head so far above everybody else and his nose so much in the air, and I don't think he really cared about playing in Ryder Cup. It didn't make him any money. It wasn't winning him any majors. It was taking time away from home or whatever else he wanted to do, selling some more Nike shoes or something. I don't know what else. But you know what? He was invested in this, and he was never invested in the Ryder Cup as a player that I ever saw.
I think the difference this time, Fred, though, was, you know, back in the day, I think it was more, when he lost matches in Ryder Cup, it was more down to his playing partners and him himself playing poorly. I think many of his playing partners, like you said there, I think they were almost intimidated by him in the past. The guys like Chris Riley even, or some of the guys he was paired with through the years in Ryder Cup, you know, Davis Love, guys who he regularly destroyed in the Ryder Cup, you know, in regular tour events all the time. And I think they were intimidated to play alongside him. But now you have these young guys who have never really played against Tiger at his peak, so they view him more as being their hero, as being someone to look up to, not as somebody to be intimidated by. And generally speaking, most of the guys get on quite well with Tiger, whether you like him or not, or whatever you may think of Tiger Woods. Most of the guys get on fairly well with him. They respect him as obviously the player that he was, but you know, he's okay a one-to-one level with them all. And I think these younger guys now, they look at Tiger as being a guy to look up to, not as a guy to be afraid of, when perhaps 10, 15 years ago, many of the other American players, because they were being so battered and brutalized by him every week on tour, they were almost intimidated by him and didn't feel they could actually stand alongside him as an equal.
I got just a couple more points I want to make on the Ryder Cup, and I'm going to run through them briefly, and then I'll let you comment on them. The playing on through commercials to not miss any action. You know, Workday, Geico, U.S. Bank, National Car Rental, Microsoft, American Express, Samsung, Michelob Ultra all bought into that. That I thought that was great with a split screen, and they could keep the action going. That was fantastic. The 13th man, Arnie's 1975 Ryder Cup bag on the first tee. Wow, that was fabulous. And then in the opening ceremony, Tony Jacklin and Jack Nicklaus came out. It was actually the best part of the opening ceremony. And they talked about the concession in 1969. And then with the amount of people that was around that stage and everyone paying attention to what Jack and Tony was saying, and they set the tone for sportsmanship and what the Ryder Cup is supposed to be about, that was an electric moment. That was really, really cool, Kieran.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, the opening ceremony seemed to me to be even worse than usual. You know, usually it's terrible, but this time it was almost lifeless and terrible. At least when Justin Timberlake came on and did that bizarre poem, that was so bad it was actually quite funny. This time there was no kind of levity to it at all. But those two, like you say, Jack and Tony, they came on there. As much as Tony looked a bit awkward trying to read the autocue at times, they carried each other really well. Jack was there, he was supporting him, and you know, they gave across the message that you want to hear. And particularly, obviously, in light of Arnold Palmer passing away recently, I think it was a nice touch to have two guys from that era come over and talk about what the Ryder Cup means to all players of that generation and what it really should be at heart. And it was a really nice touch. I think Jack did really well there, and Tony as well. So it was a nice touch. But the opening ceremony, I think, you know, can we either maybe have the opening ceremonies behind closed doors or just ban them entirely? Because without fail, as a whole, they're terrible. They're absolutely terrible. Here's a question for you, Fred. What is more likely to happen? What is more likely to happen? Tiger to win another major again, or there ever being a decent opening ceremony? What's more likely?
Maybe I'll get Beyonce or somebody out there to put on the show or something. Hey, let's go to a short break, and then we'll go to the backspin and wrap up the other events for the weekend. Carlos, can you take us into break, please?
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back. And Kieran, I'm just going to run through real quick a couple other events that were played last weekend. If you needed your golf fix in the morning before the Ryder Cup came on the air, there was an event on the LPGA Tour last week in China. The Ryanwood Classic was won by In Kyung Kim, who captured her fourth career title at the Ryanwood LPGA Classic. Kim's clutch eagle on the par 5 16th proved to be the difference as she went 4-under in her final four holes. She's 28 years old, became the third oldest winner on the LPGA Tour this year, behind Anna Nordqvist, who was 29, and Brittany Lang, 30. Everybody else, I think, has been below the age of 23. The LPGA continues her late-season Asian swing and moves over to Taiwan for the Fubon LPGA Taiwan Championship this week. The LPGA Tour also announced a new event for next year, the Indy Women Intech IWIT Championship, presented by Guggenheim, will be held in Indy next September. With Guggenheim Life as the title sponsor, the tournament will feature a full field, 144 players competing for a $2 million purse. Man, they really needed another full field tournament. They just don't have enough. That's the one thing they don't have enough of on the LPGA tournament, on the LPGA Tour. A lot of the tournaments, especially these ones at the here at the end of the year, are 81-player fields. They're invitationals. They need some more full field events for these young women that are coming up. The event will be held at the Brickyard Crossing Golf Course, a Pete Dye design course that weaves through the famed Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It'll be held September 7th through the 10th next year. And on the Symetra Tour, Marlene Sagstrom got her third win this season. It's the best season ever for anyone on the Symetra Tour. She stumbled early in the final round but made three straight birdies in the middle of the front nine and won her third tour event this year at the Murphy USA El Dorado Shootout. She finished with a three-day total of 7-under-209 to win by two shots. The first-place check of $15,000 increases her record-setting total to $156,184 for this year. Earlier, she became the first player to ever go over $100,000 in 1 year, and now she's the first to surpass $150,000. We're going to be seeing her next year on the LPGA Tour. Kieran, any final comments on the Ryder Cup or these women's tournaments before we head over to the par 5 news?
Well, Fred, I'd like to mention an event that you didn't bring up there, which was actually in Japan, the Japan Women's Open, where quite a remarkable victory there for a young player. And that's actually a major championship on the Japan LPGA Tour. And a 17-year-old amateur called Nasa Hatoka, and she's the youngest ever winner of that event, and she is younger than Ai Miyazato was, and she was 20, 3 years younger. And this young girl, she is also the junior world championship winner. She won that in America this year for the second straight year. So there's a remarkable young talent who, if we talk about Lydia Ko and all these great young players, maybe there's a great name there from Japan going to emerge in the coming years. Nasa Hatoka. Don't forget the name.
We like to watch our young players and see them do well on this show. We try to do that all the time. Make sure we get those names up there. Good catch there, Kieran. Moving into the par 5 news, Kieran, you're going to take the tee shot today, and you're going to talk a little bit about Arnie's memorial service that was held today in Orlando.
Yes, the wonderful memorial ceremony and service to Arnold Palmer, of course, we lost 9 days ago at the age of 87. Obviously, probably the saddest loss in the history of golf, a man who obviously really defined the game as we know it today, bringing so much money and attention to the game during that era of the late 1950s when golf first emerged on television. He was the king for so many reasons, and obviously the way he handled people throughout the years and with the fans, the relationship he had with the fans and other players. And he was just a larger-than-life character, but that's what he really was like, and he was it was a very sad loss last weekend. And obviously it overshadowed some of the Ryder Cup build-up there. America wrote to win that trophy in his honour, and that was a lovely touch. But this remarkable ceremony today, which I've only seen little bits of it from, obviously I was at St. Andrews today, so I haven't seen too much of it live, but I saw some of the the clips and some of the quotes that came out of it, but it looked like a remarkable ceremony where hundreds of people turned up in terms of names. Jack Nicklaus was there, Annika Sorenstam was there, Lee Trevino turned up, Phil Mickelson, Nancy Lopez, Tim Fincham, Peter Dawson, Jim Nantz, and all these other variety of faces from the game. They turned up to pay tribute to the king, and obviously his family was there as well. And it was a wonderful ceremony, and Ricky Fowler and Bubba Watson and David Love, they brought the Ryder Cup trophy to the ceremony as well to obviously
don't
bring that
Phil.
To Arnold.
Don't forget
Phil.
Phil.
Yeah, he was there too, that's right. So a nice touch there. And well, Phil's the captain, really, isn't he? So
both captains were there. Yeah.
Both captains were there. The main captain and the assistant captain, he was there too. but yeah, and it was a wonderful ceremony from what I've seen. Actually, I must say the tribute that Sam Saunders, his grandson, paid to him was just, you know, remarkable. How he is able to be so composed and giving that speech about his grandfather was wonderful. And his words were, you know, he could be a, you know, if Sam Saunders was running for president right now, he'd win because he speaks so well. And it was a wonderful speech, and reflecting on his relationship with his grandfather, who he called Dumpy, of course. That was the name for his granddad. And he spoke about two phone calls with his grandfather. One, he always called up his granddad whenever he wanted to talk to him, and he always took his call. So he called him one day, and his granddad, Arnold, always said to him, you know, where are you? That was always his first quote to him was, where are you? So he said that to him, and they said, well, I'm playing an event, Dumpy. I'm playing in some web.com tour event. Where are you? I'm with the president. What? The president of the USA. So Al Palmer was in the Oval Office with President George W. Bush, and he still took Sam's call, which was amazing, because he wanted to speak to him. And then on Sunday, before Al passed away, he was due to go in for heart surgery before his condition turned late in that day, also to turned out critically ill and gravely ill. But before they had that, Sam called him at 4 p.m. on Sunday and spoke to him for a few moments, and they had a really nice conversation. They both said to each other, I love you, I love you too. And that was the last words they said to each other. And Sam said to me, he'll cherish that memory forever. He's so happy that he made that call to his grandfather. And it was a really nice speech. And the final was a lovely ceremony. We had, obviously, Arnold's plane flying from above. He was a great aviation fan. He loved his planes. He was a fanatic. Actually, he did it to really overcome a fear of flying, which was quite incredible. So it was a remarkable man. But obviously, some of the tributes there. Jack Nicklaus was there, of course. Obviously, as someone who's been associated with Arnold for 60 years now, reflecting on his friend and obviously a former rival. And it was just wonderful memories. And it was a nice public celebration, which I think in the end, Arnold Palmer was such a public figure to have a celebration like that, that people could go and watch themselves and watch it live on streaming or on TV. It made for a really special thing because people around the world loved Arnold Palmer. And this was a great show of appreciation for that love they had for him. And it was a nice tribute, emotional, poignant, but it was a celebration of a very, very great life and a fantastic career and an enduring legacy that we will never, ever forget, Fred.
Yeah, I too just caught bits and pieces of it today as I was in and out and doing different things. One thing I did catch, though, was Jack's segment.
Yeah.
It was very moving. He did a fantastic job. You could see he had to struggle getting through it. You know, Arnie's death is a big blow for him. But the most, the thing that got me the most was Annika Sorenstam's part. And I urge anybody, if you didn't catch it today, they're playing it again this evening. I'm actually taping it because I want my wife to see parts of it. Annika spoke of Arnie's involvement in the Arnold Palmer Hospital and the Winnie Palmer Hospital for Women and Children. Of course, her second child, Will, was born prematurely, and the hospital there, the Winnie Hospital, did everything they could do, and he was only 2 pounds, 8 ounces, or 8 inches when he was born, and they had to put him in an incubator, and he was there for some time, and you know, he's a wonderful young boy now. But had it not been for that hospital, you know, who knows what would have happened. So Annika was very thankful, and she was very close to Arnie and always helps promote the hospital whenever she can. Sorry. Okay, moving on. I have just a little short piece here. The if I can get through it. Oh, man. I think I'm going to die, guys. The finals are set for the drive, chip, and putt at Augusta. 80 junior golfers representing 30 U.S. states and one Canadian province have earned an invitation to Augusta National to compete in the 4th Annual Drive, Chip, and Putt National Finals to be played on the Sunday before the start of the Masters, April 2nd. It's a joint initiative by the Masters, the United States Golf Association, and the PGA of America. It's open to boys and girls ages 7 through 15. They compete in separate divisions in four age categories, and it's exactly what it says. They hit off a tee. They hit three drives. They measure those. They do some chipping, and they do some putting, and they have numbers assigned to all those, and the winner is decided. You know, and the big thing for me about this, guys, is that these kids, it's not a team situation. It's not like football, basketball, little league, or soccer where you got a team around you. You have to do it on your own. There's no trophy for participation. There are winners and losers. You know, some complain that the drive, chip, and putt caters more to the country club set, but I argue that it's open to all kids, and they each have an equal chance of making it to Augusta for the finals. It teaches kids the need for practice, discipline, and the competitive fire to win. This is a great event, guys. I look forward to it every year. I went to a regional qualifier here in Toledo earlier this year. It's really good stuff to watch. I enjoyed it a lot. And if you ever get a chance, you should go out and check out a drive, chip, and putt event. And if you have a child that has any desire at all to play some golf, this is a great thing to point them to and get them playing a little bit. Kieran, you're going to talk a little bit about Dustin Johnson being named PGA Player of the Year.
Yes, I am, Fred, and he was indeed named PGA America Player of the Year. They have a point system to determine this award, and he won 90 points for the year. Jason Day came in second with 74 points. And how did Dustin earn these points? Well, he won 30 points by winning the U.S. Open at Oakmont. He also won 20 combined points for wins in the WGC Bridgestone and the BMW Championship. And he also gained 20 points for leading the money list and 20 more for capturing the Varden Trophy, which, of course, is the lowest scoring average award, which he won with an average score of 69.172. Adam Scott, Alton Huff, was actually in second place for that. And so, award for Dustin Johnson. I'm sure the PGA Tour Player of the Year award will come to him very soon. He certainly deserves that. Even though Rory won the FedEx Cup and played great towards the end of the season, you know, Dustin overall was the best player. He's really made a breakthrough for himself this year. And in the end, Dustin Johnson is, you know, he pretty much is the world number one right now. Not on paper, of course, so Jason Day is still there. But the last 6 months, Dustin has clearly been the best player in the world consistently. And also, a news for him as well, he's re-signed his apparel and footwear deal with Adidas Golf for a long-term deal with them, which of course ends any speculation he may have been leaving them to go to Nike perhaps, who of course are sticking in the apparel and footwear business going forward, obviously leaving the club manufacturing side of things. So Dustin will remain a part of Adidas Golf going forward for a long-term future. And even though Dustin Johnson obviously he kind of underperformed at the Ryder Cup, but off the course the accolades are coming in, and certainly deservedly so, because he had a fantastic season, a breakthrough season, really. He's finally now kind of getting the achievements and achieving the awards and major titles that his talent has long been identified to have, and he's now finally becoming a great player like we all knew he could have been, Fred.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, he had a fantastic year. We decided about a month ago that he was the player of the year, and the awards are going to start coming to him now for sure. Serious golf collectors know the name Tom Stewart. He is one of the most unique shops in the world at Pinehurst. His Old Sport and Gallery is a must-see when any golfer visits Pinehurst. Ben Wright has contracted Pure Golf Auctions and Tom Stewart to auction his memorabilia on an online auction, September 29th through October 16th of this year. Many of the items in the collection feature historical artifacts. Ben, of course, was the voice of the Masters for over 23 years, has broadcast numerous golf tournaments from the Ryder Cup to local charity events, and got a raw deal from the women's rights people of the world and lost his job. I have amassed, Ben said of his collection, I have amassed these auction items with both diligence and great affection over 7 decades of collecting golf memorabilia. But at the age of 84, I believe the time is ripe for other lovers of our great game to enjoy them, hopefully as I have. Because Tom Stewart has been my good friend and collection guru for many years, I could not think of a better expert to handle the sale of my prized possessions. So, PureGolfAuctions.com is where you want to go if you want to buy some of Ben Wright's memorabilia. If not, go to Tom Stewart's Old Sport and Gallery in Pinehurst, North Carolina. You can also find him online. He has just wonderful stuff. I walked through his store a couple times. Every time I go to Pinehurst, I make sure to go down there. He's a wonderful gentleman. He has a tremendous history. He is one of the most unique people you'll ever meet in your life. He is truly a Renaissance man. Kieran, that wraps up everything that I have for the Par 5 news. Do you have anything for final putts? You got any final putts you want to talk to us about before we get out of here tonight?
Well, just to say to anybody who's obviously having a bit of a golf withdrawal symptom right now after the Ryder Cup, and obviously there's not any PGA Tour action this week, then be sure to tune in to the Alfred Dunhill Links Championship from Scotland, where we have obviously some fantastic European players. Six of the European Ryder Cup team are going to be there. A lot of celebrities, sports stars, movie stars, musicians as well. They're all going to be there playing in three fantastic golf courses. The Old Course of St Andrews, Carnoustie and Kingsbarns, three of the world's best links courses. And the weather forecast is going to be fantastic throughout the week, it looks like. So it'll be a nice little celebration, a little showpiece of links golf, and something a little bit calmer and more subdued to watch, something a bit more calming and relaxing to watch, Fred. So if you're a golf lover, be sure to tune in and watch that this week.
I will certainly do that. All four major champs commit to the HSBC WGC event over in China. Rory commits to Elza South African Open. The Asian Pacific Amateur is going to be held this week. And, of course, you know, the winner of that gets the exemption into the Masters. And I don't know if you saw the pictures or not of the float plane that flew into Lake Hazeltine on Sunday afternoon. The police had to go out on a boat and arrest the guy and take him away. But I guess he was looking for a good view of the Ryder Cup matches. So, Kieran, any parting thoughts before we sign off?
No, thank you, Fred. It's been fun to join you as always on the show, and I apologize for my late arrival on the show. A bit of a problem there trying to get the right phone number, but a pleasure as always to talk the Ryder Cup with you. Obviously, it was a very exciting Ryder Cup. Obviously, the standard was incredible. But in the end, I think overall having a competitive competition, the cup switching sides, that's always a healthy thing for us all. So, Fred, America, enjoy the Ryder Cup. But in 2 years' time, we're going to get it back.
That closes out another Back Nine Report. It was a spectacular week of golf at the Ryder Cup, one that I will not soon forget. I can't wait until 2018 for the next one in Paris, Kieran. Thanks for filling in for Carlos. We both appreciate your efforts. You put in and the knowledge you bring to the show. It's always great to have you on. Until next week, good night, Back Niners. We hope you will be safe and enjoy the great game of golf. Good night.
Good night, everybody.